This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Now, the state Senate passed a Republican-sponsored bill yesterday that would ban providing certain types of gender-affirming medical care to people under the age of 18. Governor Tony Evers has promised to veto that bill. It's part of a nationwide wave of legislation on transgender issues, and advocates for transgender youth say even bills that don't become law can send a negative message. Our next guest has been following research on the impact of gender-affirming medical care and the politics related to it. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this bill to ban this gender-affirming medical care for minors here in Wisconsin? Would you like to see the governor veto it, as he has said he would, or sign it? Are you or a friend or family member transgender and or seeking the kind of care we're talking about? What is your perspective on this? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Alethea Zamatakis is a research assistant professor at Northwestern University's Institute for Sexual and Gender Minority Health and Well-Being, with a focus on translational health for LGBTQ plus populations. Alethea, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Your research, I understand, focuses on healthcare, but the issue of transgender care has entered the political arena. I understand you're trying to stay on top of current legislation around the country. Can you talk about what you're seeing here in Wisconsin and how it fits into this wider wave of legislation in states?
Yeah, I think what we're seeing in Wisconsin is very similar to what's happening across numerous other states. Wisconsin, as you mentioned, is seeking to pass two bills that would ban gender-affirming care for minors and also ban doctors from performing gender-affirming care on minors and revoking their licenses if they do so. This is fairly in line with 22 other states that have banned gender-affirming care so far, primarily in the South as well as in the Midwest, and five other states that have also made it a felony to provide such care. And so this is really part of a larger pattern of an assault on transgender health and transgender people across the country.
Now, some of the lawmakers in favor of the bill have used terms like mutilation to describe gender-affirming care, referring, I think, to some of the surgeries that might be involved in gender-affirming care. Can you talk us through, though, what gender-affirming medical care consists of for minors of different ages?
Yeah, so gender-affirming care for minors doesn't begin until somewhere between 9 to 12 years old, depending on when an individual starts to go through puberty. For individuals that young, what would happen is they would be prescribed puberty blockers, which essentially delay puberty. They don't prevent puberty. They don't change anything permanently about the body. They just simply stop puberty from happening until the child goes off the blockers. And this allows them the time then to wait until they're about 15 years old, and at that time decide whether they want to go on hormone replacement therapy in order to develop breasts and, for example, to not develop a deeper voice or other quote-unquote masculine features for transgender girls, or to go on testosterone and start to develop facial hair, broader facial features, for example, for transgender boys. Transgender kids really in general do not have surgeries. Most places, especially in Wisconsin, do not provide gender-affirming surgeries to individuals under 18. Children's Wisconsin, for example, only provides gender-affirming top surgery to patients 18 and older, and the same goes for UW Health. For any type of gender-affirming care that children are receiving, they have to first undergo extensive evaluation by therapists and social workers, providers, receive parental support. And, you know, this isn't happening, as some legislators have tried to say, to three-year-olds or four-year-olds. Gender-affirming care isn't something in this way that is needed until they reach puberty. Otherwise, gender-affirming care looks like providing children with access to therapy and social workers to help them cope with a world that, you know, really isn't made for other kids like them.
Alethea Zemetakis is with us from Northwestern University's Institute for Sexual and Gender Minority Health and Well-Being, talking about gender-affirming medical care after the state legislature passed a ban on that kind of care for people under 18. The governor expected to veto it. You can join in with your thoughts or your questions or maybe your own experiences in your family at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Alethea, when it comes to starting on puberty blockers, people might hear, okay, age 9 to 12. That's pretty young for a pretty big decision, even if made with in consultation with parents and healthcare professionals. Can you talk about what a little more about what goes into that decision in that age range?
Yeah, so really what goes into the decision is extensive consultation with the parent and the child to ensure that they fully understand what is happening, that they understand that, you know, this is not just a decision that they are coming into one day and changing the next, but that this is something extensive, and that they will have to continue to come in and receive ongoing monitoring. There are extensive psychological examinations to evaluate essentially whether a child is experiencing what's called gender dysphoria, or in other words, a sort of anxiety that results from a mismatch between how one sees themselves and what their body looks like. And those evaluations, you know, work to suss out if there are issues of body dysmorphia or gender dysmorphia, whether depression or anxiety or other co-occurring mental health concerns might be factoring into the child's concerns at the moment. And then only after those consultations is the child able to actually begin puberty blockers.
What do we know about research when it comes to, you know, the impact of starting puberty blockers for that kid, say age 9 to 12, versus somebody in the same position with gender dysphoria who doesn't get that? What are the trade-offs? What are the pros and cons of doing it versus not doing it?
Yeah, the benefits of doing it are huge. Gender-affirming care not only is highly safe, but individuals undergoing care as children have enormous benefits. Studies have found that transgender youth who've received such care are 60% less likely to develop depression, 73% less likely to be suicidal. Gender-affirming care also boosts overall mood and happiness. It boosts and enhances relationship stability, ability to really focus and participate in school. And it additionally, you know, ensures that these effects remain over their lifetime. For transgender adults who begin gender-affirming care later in life because they didn't have access to it as a child, there can be an increase in distress in terms of that gender dysphoria because of differences that have emerged because of puberty, such as a deeper voice, which is something that really, for the most part, can't be surgically treated. And so puberty blockers really allow a child to have control over what their body will look like in the future. And as I said, the effects are entirely reversible of puberty blockers. So if a child starts them and at 15 or 16 or 17 says, actually, I want to go through puberty the way my body otherwise would have, they are able to stop puberty blockers and fully begin the process of puberty as they otherwise would have. Children are extensively monitored for any minimal side effects, such as there can be slight calcium loss, for example, but there are ways to prevent that and treat that that doctors really watch out for. And we know that research tracking transgender people has found that only 1% of trans people actually experience any type of regret from receiving this type of care as children or as adults, which is much lower than many other types of care that is regularly provided without any attempts to ban it by legislators.
We're talking to Alethea Zemetakis, research assistant professor at Northwestern University's Institute for Sexual and Gender Minority Health and Well-Being, She's helping us understand a bill that would ban gender-affirming medical care for youth in Wisconsin and how it affects transgender people. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest? Thoughts on this effort in the state legislature? Do you want to see the governor block it or no? If you're a medical professional, do you work with the LGBTQ plus community? Do you do some of the treatments that we're talking about, if you'd care to share your experience? Or if you've been through this yourself as a parent, a child, please call in 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our conversation with Alethea Zamatakis, Research Assistant Professor at Northwestern University's Institute for Sexual and Gender Minority Health and Well-Being, talking with her about a bill that, if it were signed into law, would ban gender-affirming medical care for minors in Wisconsin, passed both chambers with Republican backing in the legislature. Governor Evers, Democrat, expected to veto the bills. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Another few minutes if you want to join in. Do you have questions about gender-affirming medical care, what the Wisconsin bill would and wouldn't do? What do you want to see happen? Is this affecting your life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Alethea, I know there are concerns about whether or not bills like these end up becoming law. The fact of their introduction being seen as sending a message to transgender youth and their families, the trans community as a whole. What do you see the potential impact there?
Yeah, the impact is huge. We know from other states that have worked to pass similar legislation that even when it's vetoed by the governor, you know, these types of bills send transgender children and their families into a state of panic. Families have to question, you know, do I need to find a job elsewhere? Do we need to move? How do I take care of my child? And most people can't afford to just pick up and move across state borders. And so then, you know, for parents who are trying to be supportive systems for their children, that's a high level of distress to know that really there is nothing in that moment you can do to protect your child from legislators who are seeking to pass bills further oppressing them. For children themselves, transgender kids already have higher rates of depression, anxiety, and suicidality than non-transgender children. And these types of bills only increase those rates by telling children that people like them are not wanted here, are not welcome here, are seen as mentally ill, are seen as having bodies that are quote unquote mutilated. You know, very dehumanizing language that is used in order to refer to transgender people in order to pass these bills that really affects the ongoing health of transgender children and adults. But also, in addition to that, as legislators attempt to pass these bills, they spread a ton of misinformation. You know, when they speak about children 3 years old receiving surgeries, when they speak about these surgeries as mutilation, when they speak about gender-affirming care as somehow lacking evidence, despite the backing of numerous studies detailing that it is a fully safe and beneficial process. This type of information is spread to the public, and the public then spreads it to other people that they know. And this misinformation spreads like wildfire, further perpetuating these myths, this misinformation, and this dehumanizing language beyond just the legislature.
We are talking about gender-affirming medical care. A bill in Wisconsin would ban it. Governor Evers expected to veto it. The concerns have been raised by Republican sponsors of this bill, Alethea, that, you know, yes, the medical community opposes this ban for the most part in Wisconsin. Republicans arguing that research can change, views can change, and that we may change our mind on this. What do you think of that?
100% research can change. But in terms of whether or not research changes to say that gender affirming care is no longer beneficial, that is just entirely implausible. numerous studies have evaluated thousands of transgender youth and adults across the country, and not just in the United States, but in other countries as well. And this research continues to show the same effects and the same level of safety of these procedures. The reality is that any changes in research regarding gender-affirming care will be research studying how to enhance this care, research studying how to ensure better access to this type of care, not research finding that gender-affirming care is suddenly no longer beneficial. That's simply not how the science works.
Time for one quick call. Elise is with us in Ashland. Elise, hi.
Hi, can you hear me?
Loud and clear. What did you want to bring up?
Fantastic. Well, just that, you know, I've been seeing these bills come up in so many different states. I live in Wisconsin. I'm trans. And my boyfriend lives in Missouri. My fiance, actually, lives in Missouri, and he's trans the other direction. And just saying it's about kids is always such a stalking horse, right? Because we've seen this come up in so many other states, and in many of them, they say, oh, it's a ban for minors, but they define minors as anyone under 26 or anyone under 30. And then in Missouri a few weeks ago, the attorney general unilaterally banned it for everyone, including adults. Now, that was ultimately struck down by the courts, but I mean, you know, we can see this is their goal, and this is not.
Elise, we just have a few moments left. Thanks for calling. Alethea, this spreading, and that's true in some states, as Elise says, to older ages as well.
Yes, 100% true. And primarily for transgender adults, these bans are attempting ban the care being provided through Medicaid, for example. And so really what we see is that legislators will continue to attack trans children, will continue to attack poor trans people, and will continue to spread this further as an ongoing assault on transgender people.
Alethea, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Alethea Zamatakis, Research Assistant Professor at Northwestern University's Institute for Sexual and Gender Minority Health and Well-Being. We talked to her about legislation that would ban gender-affirming medical care for minors in Wisconsin. It passed the legislature. Governor Evers is expected to veto it. Participation in high school football in Wisconsin declined more sharply than in any other state over a 10-year period. This year, some high school football teams have had to forfeit games. Other schools are finding they no longer have enough players to finish out their seasons. Corrine Hess reports on how schools are adapting to fewer kids playing football.
It's homecoming at Bigfoot High School in Walworth County, and the stands are packed with parents and students gathered to watch their team crush Monroe.
And now the starting lineup for your Bigfoot Williams Bay Chiefdogs.
Before the game, student Valak Channing says he's feeling confident about his school.
Well, we're going to catch a dub here. We're going to mercy rule these kids.
But this homecoming game is different. This year, the Friday night lights are shining down on the boys' varsity soccer team. Bigfoot's homecoming football game and the two games leading up to it were canceled. Bigfoot only has six seniors on its football team, and key players got hurt. District Administrator Doug Parker says, ideally, each class would have about 15 football players. But over the last several seasons, fewer kids are playing.
If we had JV kids that were eligible to play, we would. But we're not going to put a 5'1", 110-pound freshman on a varsity football field just to play a varsity game.
Bigfoot is not alone. Wisconsin saw a nearly 25% decrease in 11-player football from 2009 to 2019, according to the latest data available from the National Federation of State High School Associations. That's the largest decline in high school football participation in the country. The reason for the decrease in participation is hard to pinpoint. Experts say one factor could be anxiety about concussions. In some cases, boys may be choosing to play a different fall sport, such as soccer or volleyball. And some decline in participation may be because high schoolers prefer screens to sports. In Wisconsin, boys' soccer participation is up about 4% over the last decade, while boys' volleyball is up about 20%. But those fall sports still draw far fewer players than football. Most states have seen fall participation decline. A few, including Texas, have seen slight increases. Krista Niehoff heads the federation that tracked this data. She believes when new participation numbers are released, football will still be at the top of its game nationally.
Overall, interest in the sport of football is healthy. We're not sure about what's happening in Wisconsin.
Todd Clark with the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association says the biggest drop in football participation was between 2012 and 2016. That coincides with more media coverage of contact sports causing concussions. Since then, Clark says the number of football participants has flatlined. Clark says schools with strong football programs have tended to see less drop-off in participation.
It hasn't been a secret. Successful programs draw kids in because people like to win.
At Bigfoot, the soccer team was more than happy to take the homecoming spotlight for the evening. Looking out at the stands before the game, soccer star Hudson Torres says he had never seen so many fans.
I mean, football has always been a big sport. I mean, we won state in like 2009 for football. So, I mean, it's good to see a different change with soccer now. We're ranked 9th in the state, so I think people are starting to really like come and enjoy the games.
For the most part, parents and students didn't mind the change either. Nicole Raskin, who is a student council advisor and the parent of a senior, says making the switch to soccer was the best solution the school could come up with.
As a parent, we have heard only positive. Every single comment said, we hope our football players get healthy, and we're very excited to see the soccer team get this experience.
And even without the football game, Bigfoot High School was able to keep their homecoming traditions alive. They crowned the homecoming queen and king at halftime, and as predicted, the team won their game. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can find that story and more Wisconsin news online at WPR.org. And you can check out archives of our conversations here on the Ideas Network, including, I just looked this up, from 2018, did an interview about a lot of Wisconsin schools moving to 8 players on a side versions of football for related reasons to that news story. Find all that at WPR.org or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, Wisconsin U.S. Senator Ron Johnson joins the show for a look at the latest news in the U.S. Senate and efforts to prevent future risks of government shutdown, including some legislative changes he is calling for. Then you could check out a Milwaukee restaurant that's getting some national attention on a New York Times food list. Then get an update on the latest in the war between Israel and Hamas. That's all coming up tomorrow morning. It starts at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Living in Wisconsin, do you think we're part of the Midwest? For most of us, the answer is yes, according to a new survey, though we're not the most Midwestern of the Midwest. I saw this in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The Emerson College Survey Center and the Midwest Review teamed up. They polled a bunch of people in 22 states in the general, roughly north central part of the U.S. Do you consider yourself to live in the Midwest? Here in Wisconsin, 93.6% of us said yeah. Pretty high, but not number one. Iowa and Minnesota residents are up over 96%. The least Midwestern states, no surprise, were on the fringes of the survey. Only 9% of Pennsylvanians said they were in the Midwest. The biggest surprise to me, 2/3 of people in Oklahoma said they were in the Midwest. That's on the border of Texas. That's pretty far south for my version of the Midwest. But I guess, hey, it's a Midwestern state of mind. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, planet Earth is over 4.5 billion years young. A Wisconsin geologist joins the show for a look at contemplating deep time and how it can affect the way we think about the world we live on. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about a Wisconsin couple falling in love.
Prior to 1972, girls didn't always have the opportunity to play sports at school. But the passage of Title IX changed that. It paved the way for Manitowoc's Roncalli girls basketball team to become the sport's first state champions in 1975. Two former teammates talked with one another about that experience as part of a StoryCorps mobile tour stop in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
My name is Barb Barenbrook-Luring. I am 65 years old.
I am Sue Tringali Johnson. I am 66. So we grew up in Manitowoc, Wisconsin, and our city recreation department did have organized girls basketball teams for grade school and high school. But at that point in time, we were playing, knowing we were going to be going into high school, where there were no sports teams for girls.
But ta-da, enter the passage of Title IX, the fact that our private high school, Manitowoc Roncalli, received public assistance for lunches, which meant they were getting public assistance, so they would have to begin offering sports for girls too. So when we got to school, we found out that we were going to have a basketball team. We felt like we won the lottery.
In the summer of 1972, the budgets were already done, and all the money, of course, was at that point pledged to the boys' sports teams. So that meant the budget for the girls was zero, right? Nothing. Assistant coach Sue Schneider, who was a...
Her mom was like an excellent seamstress. She came to a practice one night and she measured each of us girls and put together a pair of polyester navy blue shorts that she custom sewed for each of us. So the pants are taken care of.
The school did step up a little bit and ordered light blue polyester sleeveless tops with these giant numbers on them and no school name. But we had shorts, our sleeveless tops with the giant numbers, so we were going to be able to play. And actually, we finished our high school season with an 8-3 record.
Pretty good for a first season.
So our second season, we were undefeated. Officially, we did win sectionals, but we really wanted a full state tournament like the boys had, right? Not
right.
Stopping at regionals. And then it changed because then we found out for the 1974-75 season when I was a senior and you're a junior, mm-hmm. just in time, right?
Just in
for
time.
For me, they announced that there'd be the first tournament for girls in the state of Wisconsin.
And we did actually make it to the state tournament, which was February 22nd, 1975. So we won our semifinal game against Milwaukee Lutheran, which meant we would be playing Racine St. Catherine.
It was a super close game, 65-62. Actually pretty high scoring. And this was in the day of no three-point shot.
No three-pointers, right.
So we won, you know, and it was an amazing experience. And I know tears just started immediately because, you know, all the things we work for. It just was like, there, it's all coming back for me right now, which is crazy. And then we got the trophy and all that, and it was super cool. And we were in Madison, and it was about a three-hour ride back to Manitowoc. And it just so happened that the boys were playing. So the gym was packed. We were introduced at halftime, walked out, standing ovation. It was like just super cool.
It was a real moment of validation for those of us that were there that felt like basketball was really important. And just imagine that group of us girls, but there were girls all over the country whose lives were changed forever by Patsy Mink, Congressman, our representative Patsy Mink, and her congressional colleagues, and a president who together created our powerful Title IX movement. It was like the stars were just all lined up. It was pretty cool.
That was Barb Barenbrook-Luring and Sue Tringali Johnson, formerly of Manitowoc. Their interviews were recorded at StoryCorps, a national initiative to record and collect stories of everyday people. Excerpts were selected and produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of WPR and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
This is Central Time. The Earth is over 4.5 billion years old. But how do we know that? The answer in large part is geology. Our next guest is a Wisconsin scientist who says geology isn't just analyzing rocks. She says it's actually a form of time travel. Every rock, every landform tells us something about the long history of the place we find it in. We're finding out now what geology can tell us about the Earth's billions of years of history and how the current human-centric era is radically changing things. You can join in at 800-642-1234. You have a favorite feature of Wisconsin's landscape. What do you want to know about our state billions of years into the past or today. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Marsha Bjornerud is the Walter Schober Professor of Environmental Studies and Professor of Geosciences at Lawrence University in Appleton. She's the author of books including Timefulness, How Thinking Like a Geologist Can Help Save the World. She's giving a talk this Sunday at 11:30 a.m. at the Culver Community Park Shelter in Prairie du Sac for the Wisconsin Academy of Sciences, Arts, and Letters to mark the end of the Wisconsin Science Festival. Marsha, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. I'm happy to be part of the show.
What do we mean by phrases like deep time and deep history?
Well, deep time is an evocative way of describing how geologists envision time as almost another dimension. I often do feel that I can, in my mind's eye, travel back in geologic time through landscapes and rocks in Wisconsin to certain times in the distant past. And it does feel like another dimension. So I think it's just a good way of conceptualizing something that would otherwise be quite abstract.
I like to read some science and a lot of science fiction. And when I look at, 4.5 billion years or 6 billion years in astronomy or whatever, I feel like my puny human brain just can't comprehend time spans of that length. As a geologist who thinks routinely in those time frames, does it ever get normal to you or does it ever feel overwhelming?
Well, I guess we get used to it. I can't say that as a human being with a finite lifespan, I really can comprehend what a million years or a billion years mean. But I think rather than focusing simply on the numbers, but instead the stories, what has happened in those great spans of geologic time, start making one get some glimpse of their magnitude. The idea that the very geography of the planet has changed over and over, that there have been many different continental configurations, oceans that have come and gone, mountain belts that rose and were eroded away. Then you start getting some sense of what billions of years means.
This is a pretty recent discovery, I think, in human terms, only over the last, century or two, maybe, we've figured out the Earth is that old. What were some of the signs, the evidence under our feet that started to point people to say, wait a minute, the Earth is a lot older than we've been thinking it is?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, the quantitative determination of the age of the Earth really emerged only in the 1930s or so, when people realized that radioactivity, a naturally occurring process, could be harnessed as a kind of timekeeper. Geologists had been working on developing the geologic timescale back as early as the early 1800s, but did not have a quantitative means of determining the age of the Earth. They had some instinct in their bones that it must be on the order of hundreds of millions of years, but had no real way of proving that. And there were many controversies between geologists and physicists who had different models for how the Earth and the solar system had formed. And geologists were in the main right about the great antiquity of the Earth.
One of the themes of your book, and I think of your talk this weekend, Marsha, is how we can take that kind of time span and then turn it back to our lifespans as humans and get a perspective, an understanding, and maybe do some good on the planet for ourselves and our descendants. What kind of things can we learn that help us in the present day from taking this long view?
Well, first of all, since Earth is our home, few of us will ever leave, and certainly will spend most of our lives here. Knowing how the planet works over different kinds of timescales is essential to living in a sustainable way on it. And arguably, many of the environmental problems we face today are the result of not thinking time fully, not thinking how our technological innovations would interact over decadal or century timescales with natural systems, burning fossil fuels that have been stored underground for millions of years in a matter of a few decades is probably premier example. So there are certainly practical reasons. I think that geology is also, interestingly, a largely philosophical field because it's about deep existential questions of how things came to be the way they are. And the past is not an arcane and irrelevant thing. It shapes the landscapes around us, and having some sense of how things came to be as we know them today is, I think, a source of some kind of almost spiritual comfort.
Let's bring on a caller. Rory is with us in Chippewa Falls. Rory, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Rory?
I grew up in Barron County in Rice Lake. In the east end of the county is the area, I was told by more than one person, that that's where the first land came up. But it was actually down in the southern part of the planet. But now it's up around the 45th parallel or so, or 47th maybe.
Rory, thanks a lot for the call. I hadn't heard that, Marcia, a piece of Wisconsin prehistory there. How would we figure that out if part of Barron County was some of the first land to emerge from the water?
Well, Barron County does have some very old rocks, including the Barron quartzite that is probably a kind of sister formation to the Baraboo quartzite in the Devil's Lake State Park area and the Baraboo Ranges. It's old, probably around 1.6 or 7 billion years old, but it's not the oldest emergent land, even in Wisconsin. So we have remarkably old rocks in parts of the state. We are actually a state with remarkable geodiversity. People may have the idea of biodiversity, many different species living in a place. Well, we have many different rock types of many different ages. And the Barron County Rice Lake area is kind of a microcosm of that. There are some relatively youngish rocks, only 500 million years old. And then there's the Barron quartzite that's a billion years older than that. Old, but not the oldest.
Rory, thanks a lot for that call. We're finding out what geology can teach us about the nature of time. Our guest is Marcia Bjornerud, professor of environmental studies and professor of geosciences at Lawrence University, speaking at an event in Prairie du Sac this Sunday. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you ever try to think about that, just how old this planet is, how it's changed, and how features have emerged? And are there things that you love to see, natural formations in Wisconsin or beyond? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about what geology can teach us about the nature of time and the planet we live on. Our guest is Marcia Bjornerud, professor of environmental studies and professor of geosciences at Lawrence University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite geological formation, something, landscape here in Wisconsin? Do you have a question for our guest? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Marcia, I'll admit to having had the misconception at various points that, you know, geology is about rocks. But as I read more and hear more about it, it's amazing how much life forms have influenced our landscapes, our landforms, our geological history on the planet. Can you talk a little bit about how much geology is a story about life as well?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And there's a growing understanding that Earth and life have co-evolved, that it's not simply that Earth was the right distance from the sun and we had water, which were prerequisites for life getting a toehold, but ever since it did, it has been actively modifying this planet for at least 3.8 billion years. And perhaps the most dramatic example of that is that microbes transformed a volcano breath atmosphere of pure carbon dioxide and some water vapor, similar to what we would see on Mars or Venus, into this wonderful oxygenated atmosphere that we enjoy today. And in fact, some of the rocks we have in northern Wisconsin, the banded iron formation up in the Gogebic Range, record that transition from a world with no oxygen in the atmosphere to one in which there was at least some O2 free oxygen in the atmosphere. And that happened about 2 billion years ago, thanks to microbes.
Now, looking at Wisconsin's geological history, somebody put a map online where you could pick a date and said, hey, if you're on this spot and time traveled back X amount of years, here's what your place would look like. And what I learned from that is if you did that in Wisconsin, you probably should have a boat, right? Wisconsin was underwater for a lot of geological history. How much was Wisconsin influenced by just being a sea, part of an ocean?
That's right. So there are many versions of Wisconsin, and I think you're talking about the long period from what we would call the Cambrian through Devonian time. That would be from about 500 million to maybe 380 million years ago. So that would be a period of about 120 million years, over which most of the time Wisconsin was a sort of continental shelf setting. The continent itself was smaller and also sea level was higher. And the rocks that we know from the southern two-thirds of the state, the sandstones and the limestones, shale, dolomite, these stratified rocks are all records of that long period of time. So yes, you would have needed a boat. At other times, you might have needed some sort of protective gear from volcanic eruptions. You would have been in the midst of great mountains that existed. So there are many, many Wisconsins represented in our rock record.
Let's bring on another caller at 800-642-1234. Gwen is with us in Horicon. Gwen, hi.
Hello. Thanks for talking.
Yeah, what did you want to ask about, Gwen?
Well, we live in the Horicon area, and our property actually sits on part of the Niagara Escarpment, and most people don't even understand what that is. And I think it'd be great if she talked about it a little bit.
All right. Marcia, introduce us to, Gwen's front yard, the Niagara Escarpment.
Gwen, I'm so glad you brought that up. We here in Appleton also are pretty close to the escarpment. So the escarpment is a step in the landscape that represents sort of the edge of a big bowl that's the size of all of lower Michigan and beyond. So there's a geological feature called the Michigan Basin, which you can think of as a bowl-shaped feature. And the rocks all around the bowl tilt very gently in toward the middle. And as erosion has acted on these stratified rocks, these sedimentary rocks we were just talking about, the soft ones have eroded away more easily than the hard ones. And the thing that really defines the escarpment is the really resistant, tough Silurian dolostone, and it's underlined by much softer shale that just is not up to standing up to erosion or glaciers. And so everywhere you see that contact between the weak shale and the strong dolostone, that's the escarpment. And in fact, it's the same feature that Niagara Falls falls over, way over in New York and Ontario. It's just that here we don't have one Great Lake draining into the other, but it's the same landscape feature that can be traced all around the Upper Great Lakes region.
Gwen, thanks a lot for the call. Marcia, one quirk, as I understand it, of geological history that probably disappoints a lot of kids, we don't seem to discover a lot of dinosaur fossils in Wisconsin. That doesn't mean they weren't here, but what happened so that we don't seem to find a lot of them here?
Right. So we have a long and wonderful history, but we do not have Jurassic and Cretaceous rocks in Wisconsin. So that means times when there is no rock record preserved means we were high and dry and exposed to erosion. So most sedimentary rocks are in fact marine sediments, and most dinosaurs were walking around on land. So during times when areas are above sea level, it's much less likely that rocks will be preserved into the geologic record.
Time for one more caller. Mitch is with us in Madison. Mitch, hello.
Hi. Let me turn down my radio. I have a question. So the original life form, or certainly one of the oldest life forms we know of, is the cyanobacteria, right? 3.8 billion years old. And when we have these outbreaks now in our lakes where those beaches aren't safe, it's cyanobacteria. And I'm curious if it's like, is that the same organism?
Mitch, thanks for the call. Yeah, cyanobacteria, we call it blue-green algae, though I think it's not really algae. Marcia, is that a close cousin of some of the earliest life forms on Earth?
Yeah, he's right, absolutely. The things that oxygenated the atmosphere were probably ancient ancestors of modern cyanobacteria. Certainly, they have evolved, but essentially, they're similar to the very first photosynthetic organisms on Earth. Today, they can be a problem if they're proliferating and overwhelming other microbial communities in our lakes and rivers. But they should be respected, I guess, for bringing us this beautiful oxygenated atmosphere.
Mitch, thanks a lot for the call. Marcia, we mentioned that talk coming up on Sunday in just our last few moments. What is the main point you're hoping to bring to people?
Well, it's called A Celebration of Time, and it's sponsored by the Wisconsin Academy of Sciences, Arts, and Letters, as well as the Wisconsin Science Festival, as you mentioned, and Badger History Group. I just learned, unfortunately, that the in-person event is sold out.
Oh, okay.
But anyone can join online. Just go to the Wisconsin Academy website, and it's free to register. I'll be speaking about the deep geologic history of Wisconsin, and then John Greendeer, who's the new president of the Ho-Chunk Nation, will also be speaking about the very long, rich human history of the Baraboo Hills region and the Badger Army ammunition site and the reclamation of that site.
Marcia, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
Marcia Bjornerud is the Walter Schober Professor of Environmental Studies and Geosciences at Lawrence University in Appleton. We'll get a link up so you can see that talk online at wpr.org/centraltime. So you can see that Wisconsin Academy link and watch online. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, phone etiquette has changed a lot. Should you text before calling? Should you leave voicemail? Talk on speakerphone in a crowded place? We'll tackle those questions and more. That's tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, bottled water is big business, but there's a lot of pushback over costs, plastic pollution, and more. We'll talk to the author of the new book, Unbottled, The Fight Against Plastic Water and For Water Justice. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.